It's Here and Now. I'm Jane Clayson in for Robin Young. The giant plume of volcanic ash from Iceland will continue to put a chokehold on worldwide air traffic into the weekend, blocking the main air flight path between the east coast of the United States and Europe. British aviation authorities extended a ban on air travel in England and Wales until tomorrow at 7 a.m. local time. Meanwhile, the Icelandic volcano that first began erupting on Wednesday is still spewing ash as high as 24,000 feet. For the latest on this story, we turn to the BBC's Inkem Ifejica. He's in London. Inkem, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
We've heard people say that this eruption is having a bigger impact on air travel than 9/11. How are travelers reacting to this news that, at least in the United Kingdom, flights are off until tomorrow?
Absolutely. I mean, the first point which you made, which is the impact it has had, there hasn't been anything this serious since 9/11. I mean, when 9/11 happened, it was just the skies over London that was closed down. But in this instance, it's the whole of the United Kingdom and large, large swathes of Europe. So it's actually quite incredible. Now, the thing about it is there are people trying to get into Europe and get out of Europe. There's an American man who is at the airport in Brussels, and he was trying to get from Brussels to Poland, but he couldn't make it.
It's part of the adventure, I have to say. I may end up not getting to go to Poland and go on down to Munich or Vienna. Would like to get over to Poland, but it may not be possible today. But you go with the flow.
Now, that's a sense of what's happening within Europe itself. Now, if you consider the fact that the area where this plume of ash is sitting is in one of the main routes which planes take to get from North America into Europe and vice versa. So people who are trying to get out of Europe into North America can't do so, like this Canadian woman who was at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris.
The plane hasn't left Canada. So until the plane leaves Canada to come here, then we can't return. And the cab driver told us that all the hotels around are full.
So what's happened now is there's a domino effect. Airports are clogged up, hotels are clogged up. So that's the personal tragedy of people.
Do we have a sense of the economic consequences of the disruption to air travel?
That's one of the main problems. The airline industry is already reeling from the economic crisis. So the last thing it needs is for the skies above Northern Europe to be shut down entirely for what is going to end up being more than 48 hours. This could easily run into hundreds of millions if we're not careful. So there's the airlines, but of course there's the wider impact. Take for example, most of the flowers, or many of the flowers that come into Europe, come from other parts of the world. They're flown in, for example, from East Africa, like this woman who is Jane Ngige. She's the chief executive of the Kenya Flower Council.
We have about 400 to 500 tons of cargo sitting at the airport in the cold rooms. That is worth about between $1.5 to $2 million. Even if this cargo was to be lifted, we have a problem of eroded quality.
Back to the domino effect of air travel and this worldwide disruption, with people looking for alternate ways to get around Europe in Chem, what's happening to train travel, which is, I know, the biggest alternate route of transportation?
Well, the rail lines are absolutely clogged up. From Paris going into, well, first of all, in France, they also have issues of strikes. So that's one issue. And this is not a good time to have that. But all the airlines are shedding their passengers, and their passengers are looking for different sorts of methods to get around.
We mentioned the volcano is still erupting, and so far the ash and debris are in this cloud up to 35,000 feet in the air. What are the health concerns here once some of the ash starts to settle to the ground?
Well, that's the thing. What health authorities here in Britain have said is, especially in the northern border of Scotland and the islands, which are just off the British Isles and closer to Iceland, they've said that, look, if you have any respiratory problems, make sure you go out with whatever medication you'd normally use to combat it.
I've heard people being encouraged to stay inside, keep their windows closed, that there are bits of glass even coming down at this point. No?
Well, that's what the threat tends to be, that there could be acid rain from this substance which is floating in the skies. But nothing has yet been said about those sorts of precautions. It's just sort of like basic things which people should do if you have respiratory problems. But as yet, what they're trying not to do is panic people. They're saying basically, stay calm. It's not yet that serious. Basically because of how high it is and how it could change depending on wind directions and wind speeds.
What is the general reaction? Is there panic?
No, there isn't panic. I think more than anything else, it's just frustration. And for some people, it's just the fact that you can't actually see this thing. For example, yesterday on Friday, people came to work in London and people were looking up into the sky and trying to see these things and trying to see dark, gloomy London. Well, yes, it was dark and gloomy as it always is in London, but it had nothing to do with the cloud. It was just the usual phenomenon of the sun trying to fight its way through the normal clouds here in Britain. But the problem is, for passengers and for people who are traveling, they're the ones who seem to be suffering more than anything else.
That cloud does look ominous, but spectacular as well. The BBC's Inkem Ifejica reporting from London on how the giant cloud of volcanic ash from Iceland is disrupting air travel and life in general in Europe. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Is it ethical to bribe school kids to get them to work harder and earn better grades? Does it create a dangerous precedent for students and teachers? Does it devalue the learning process? Well, the question one researcher wanted to answer is, does it work? The answer is more complicated than you might think. And this week, Time magazine chronicles a very unusual and comprehensive research project in which schools actually paid students money in return for academic achievement. The goal, to figure out a way to close the learning gap between more affluent whites and lower-income minority groups. Joining us from the Christian Science Monitor studios in Washington, D.C., Amanda Ripley, contributing writer to Time magazine and author of the Time cover story, Should Schools Bribe Kids? Amanda, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, tell us about the researcher who spearheaded this project, because his own personal story plays a big role in this study.
Yeah, he's a very interesting guy. Roland Fryer Jr. is an economist at Harvard. He's quite young, but he has an interesting background. He grew up poor, mostly in Texas, and largely on his own. Got into some trouble as a teenager. For a while, he was working at McDonald's and occasionally lifting from the cash register, and he carried a gun and so forth. And then once he got to college, which he got to through a basketball scholarship, he started becoming very competitive academically and started realizing that this was a place where he could excel in addition to the basketball court. So after that, he really turned his life around, works extremely hard, and now is an economist at Harvard and quite successful. But he's very interested in education and why kids in low-income schools are doing as poorly as they are doing. So he thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to pay kids and see what happens?
So tell us how the research worked then. Where did it take place? How and how much were these kids paid?
Well, it's really fascinating because Roland Fryer did something here that almost never happens in education research, which is he managed to pull off a massive controlled randomized experiment across four different cities. So in Dallas, Chicago, Washington, and New York City, he enlisted 18,000 kids and paid them a total of $6.3 million over the course of 1 to 2 years for different things. So, for example, in Chicago, kids got paid for good grades, $50 for an A, $35 for a B, and so forth. In New York City, it was for better test scores. In D.C., it was for a portfolio of different metrics, including attendance and behavior, five different things. You get paid every 2 weeks. And in Dallas, which is probably the simplest scheme, second graders got paid $2 for every book that they read, assuming they passed a short computerized quiz on the book.
So were these private schools, public schools, charter schools?
They were all public schools, in many cases spread out over a large number of different schools, and he was able to create a control group and an experimental group so that you could really compare in a meaningful sense how these kids were doing compared to kids who were very similar but not being paid.
What role did parents play in the project, if any?
Well, parents had to consent to have their kids participate in it. Interestingly, the vast, vast majority of parents did consent to have their kids participate.
And so, did it work?
Well, drum roll, it was really interesting because in places like New York City, which, you know, was just a massive number of kids involved, it's a huge school system, obviously, and they really went out on a limb to give Roland a chance to do this. They spent $1.5 million, that's private money, not to fear, on 8,000 kids, and got no results. Nothing bad happened, nothing good happened. There was no change in grades or attendance, or most importantly, from the experiment's point of view, performance on standardized tests at the end of the year. However, in Dallas, which again had that very elegant $2 per book scheme, they saw significant gains. So the kids who were getting paid to read books performed much better on their standardized reading tests at the end of the year. And just to put this in perspective, those kids performed as if they'd been in school 3 months longer than the kids who did not get paid.
And what about in Chicago and D.C.?
Chicago was interesting because the kids were getting paid, high school kids, for better grades. And the kids did indeed get better grades, and their attendance went up, which is a huge deal in low-income urban schools where mm-hmm. dropouts are so common. So they went to school about 10 days more than the kids who didn't get paid over the course of the year. However, their standardized test scores did not go up at the end of the year compared to the kids who did not get paid. And then in D.C., you see more positive results, but not quite as strong as Dallas. So in D.C., kids got paid for different things like attendance and behavior. The theory that Roland has is that if you pay kids for things that they can control, not final results like grades and test scores, but things like reading a book, coming to class, doing your homework, those things seem to lead to more learning in the long term than paying kids for results. And that could be because kids don't always know how to get results. Hmm. So even though the kids in this study seemed universally excited about earning money, and I will vouch for that. I mean, I've talked to kids who are part of this, and they're all for it. I mean, they have different opinions about its effects and its effectiveness, but they love the idea and they want to earn more. But sometimes they don't know how. Some kids are so far behind that, you know, doing better on a test score is not so easy, or they don't really know how to ask for help.
So interesting. You know, Professor Fire isn't entirely breaking ground on all this. You write that schools have been experimenting with financial incentives for a long time now. What have they done in the past, and how does Professor Fire's study compare with those previous experiments?
Actually, I'm glad you asked. There's an interesting example near Boston where schools tried to do this, and they paid kids for grades, and they did not see results. Others have tried with reading and so forth. If you look into the details of those experiments, what you see is, first of all, they were often really small and not randomized, so there was no control group to compare them to in a meaningful way, so you don't really know how they did. And then in other cases, one of the big flaws, I think, is that the feedback often comes really late. So we know that the way kids' brains are wired is that they discount the future. In other words, they are not sort of programmed to be highly motivated for long-term goals. And so you need to give them a reward, just like you need to give them punishment, fast, right? And in Dallas, kids got that feedback as soon as they took the quiz, the computerized quiz about the book they'd read. In D.C. was the most often kids got paid, so every 2 weeks.
You even talk about one case where a girl was paid for going another day without getting pregnant.
Yeah, there is a school that has experimented with paying girls for not getting pregnant. I mean, if you can think of it, somebody has paid kids, or more often, actually, rewarded kids for doing it. I mean, we don't seem to have a problem culturally with rewarding kids with, you know, pizza parties or prizes or stickers or pens. But you introduce cash, gets much, much more controversial.
We're speaking with Amanda Ripley, author of this week's Time Magazine cover story, Should Schools Bribe Kids?, which details an unprecedented experiment where thousands of school kids in four different cities were paid cash in return for academic achievement. We'll have more on the findings and what do teachers think of all this when we come back after a break. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. It's Here and Now. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Robin Young. We're talking about motivating school kids with cash. It's a controversial concept. One Harvard researcher conducted a massive multi-city study to see if it would work. This week's Time Magazine tells the story, and we're speaking with Time contributing writer Amanda Ripley. Amanda, the demographics of the 18,000 kids involved in this experiment in Dallas, D.C., Chicago, and New York, they were mostly African American and Hispanic and from low-income families. But you write that the results varied within the demographics.
Yeah, that was really interesting. In D.C., the data is particularly compelling. The experiment did seem to have a positive effect on African-American kids, and it particularly worked for boys, it appears. Hmm. And this is actually really unusual in education policy. So most reforms you can think of seem to work better on girls. But in this case, it seems like boys responded to it more. The results are driven in Dallas and D.C. by boys. And most remarkably, in D.C., it looks like boys who have a history of serious behavioral incidents, who've been suspended for bad behavior in the past, those boys got the most out of the financial incentive. So that's huge. That said, the D.C. sample was not as big or as balanced as some of the other cities, so we can't say for sure this should be done for all boys everywhere, particularly low-income boys or boys who have behavioral problems. But we can say it's much more interesting than most of the things that we are doing and spending a lot more money on.
The 143 schools that joined the effort, was it difficult to convince their school officials to allow their kids to participate?
Actually, it was wild how difficult it was. I mean, here's this Harvard professor who has, you know, millions of dollars in private charity funding to roll out a pretty serious experiment, and he had a hard time. I mean, the chancellor of New York City schools, Joel Klein, welcomed Roland and really made it happen. But, you know, still, Roland was kicked out of the New York City schools a couple of times and then let back in. And he had death threats after he went on national TV to talk about the experiment. I mean, I've noticed already since the Time story has been out, people get very emotional about this, and they almost don't seem to care whether it works. It's about something else.
Well, what is it about?
Well, I think people with education, they always think of themselves, and that's normal, right? We all have experience in school, so we all feel like we own a piece of this. And so you think, well, my parents didn't pay me. And regardless of whether it's particularly relevant to the low-income schools that we're talking about, in which, you know, they're really in crisis, so we may want to get creative in looking, at least testing solutions. I think the other thing is people romanticize kids. I know I do it too. You think that they're supposed to be there for sort of innocent reasons or sort of wondrous and magical reasons that have to do with a love of learning, and that's what's supposed to motivate them to get through school. But, I mean, I could probably count on one hand the number of times that I worked hard in school for a love of learning. I mean, you know, there were certain classes, particularly in college, where I felt that excitement. But I just don't think we're being entirely honest with ourselves if we think that that's the primary motivation, even for kids who really excel in school. And even, you know, with adults, my editor said to me, you know, it's kind of like we're holding kids up to a higher standard than we hold ourselves, since most of us work primarily for money.
So you told us about the kids' reaction and the parents' reaction. What about the teachers?
You know, it was interesting. When I talked to teachers, they seemed skeptical of this. You know, they've seen so many different experiments in their careers, and so many of them don't work. Or more to the point, very few of them are actually tested. So, you know, they get a little bit jaded, I think, after a while. And actually, a lot of the kids told me that many of their teachers were openly disdainful of this experiment. Mm. And, you know, that their teachers would say, this is ridiculous. You shouldn't get paid for something you're expected to do. And just sort of openly degrade the experiment.
So at the end of all this, Amanda, do you think there is a desire among educators to consider financial incentives to help kids do better in school? Or is our education system not quite ready to take that leap on a massive scale?
I think you're going to see huge variance, and I can't wait to see who picks this up and keeps pursuing it, because I think in some places, really effective teachers, principals, superintendents will try anything. They want to know what works. They're constantly changing it up, and they will be very interested in this, and I think that more of them will do this. I think in other places, the fear of being controversial, of turning parents or particularly affluent supporters against you, who seem to be the ones who have a bigger problem with this, that will overwhelm the actual logic of whether it works.
And what about the cost? I mean, you said $6.3 million paid out to 18,000 kids in just four cities. I mean, is that feasible on a large scale?
Great question. You know, $6.3 million sounds like a lot. If you actually were to compare that to other reforms that we've tried and are continuing to try on a much bigger scale in education, it's cheap as dirt. I mean, it's not a significant number, particularly in Dallas, where the experiment worked the best. They were paying kids $2 per book. On average, those second graders read 7 additional books. So we're talking about $14 per kid. Just to put that in perspective, to get lower class sizes, another reform that's been tried, that's like $5,000 to $7,000 per kid per year. So, you know, this is, from a cost-benefit point of view, a no-brainer.
I'm thinking a lot of parents may be out there listening to you and wondering, what are the lessons here for me? How do I put this study to use for my own child?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I think the real lesson here for parents is that rewarding kids for grades is not as effective as rewarding kids for effort. So what you want to do is reward kids for the things they can control that you feel are important and will lead to long-term results. So things like coming to class on time, doing all their homework, things like that. Because even if we all think that kids know how to get to success, as far as grades or test scores or getting into college, any of these long-term goals, no matter how bad they want it, sometimes the path there is not nearly as clear as we think.
Amanda Ripley is author of this week's Time Magazine cover story, Should Schools Bribe Kids? She's speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Amanda, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much.
Monday on Here and Now, are we sacrificing quality for quantity in America's food supply? An Academy Award-nominated documentary says yes. Also, pounding the pavement for charity, running the Boston Marathon to raise money for a cause. That's Monday. Still ahead today, micro-lending pioneer Grameen Bank takes its lessons from Bangladesh to Omaha, Nebraska. News is next, Here and Now. Today is National Healthcare Decisions Day, which probably would have passed largely unnoticed, except that President Obama has ordered new rules requiring that most hospitals recognize the visitation rights of gay couples. The rules change was in part inspired by a case of a woman from Washington State who collapsed while on vacation in Miami 3 years ago. Her partner was denied the right to be by the bedside and make medical decisions despite showing proof that she was her partner's designated health care proxy. But the new rules go well beyond gay couples. For more, we turn to Art Kaplan, professor of bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What does this rule change mean? Who does it affect?
It's enormously important because what couldn't be achieved by basically enacting marriage laws for gay individuals has now been solved through an administrative edict.
The administrative edict also extends to heterosexual couples as well, right? Or single people who rely on family and friends for support.
It does. Very important again. Common law marriages, people who've just lived together for a long time. We know who's responsible, if you will, if you're married. It's your spouse who takes precedent over everyone else in guiding your care. We saw that, for example, in the Terry Schiavo case when the husband was squared off against other relatives and the husband got control and had authority. But when you don't have that kind of legally recognized authority, many hospitals have been unwilling to grant standing to direct care to anyone who is outside the blood relatives or outside the marriage relationship. This solves that problem, and it also cuts back on the variability. You know, you'd find some hospitals that would listen to a gay partner, some hospitals that wouldn't, some hospitals that did give credence to a long-standing common-law marriage, others that wouldn't. We now have a uniform answer.
Because that varies greatly from state to state.
Variability all over the place. It varies within states. In some ways, it depended on the opinion of the legal counsel at the hospital or nursing home where you were.
Under these new rules, would you have to designate a specific person to make these decisions?
You do need to do that, and it's very important that people understand that that designation needs to take place. Now, we often get confused between a living will and what's called a surrogate or durable power of attorney. Living will is the process where you write out what you want and talk about the kinds of interventions you do or don't want. A surrogate decision maker is simply appointing someone to do decision making for you. It's the simple step, the easy step. You need to tell the person that you designate that you've designated them. I've seen that not done in a few cases. And write it down, get it notarized, update it every couple of years.
Do you need both documents?
What you really need is the designation of the decision maker. You're simply saying, I appoint Art Kaplan to be my surrogate decision maker. Make sure everyone has copies, your decision maker, your primary care doctor, probably your religious chaplain if you have that kind of an affiliation. I urge people sometimes, and I don't say this jokingly, show that document at a holiday gathering. Let people know who your decision maker is.
What if a hospital professor chooses not to comply? Is there real teeth to these new rules?
There is. I think you would find yourself probably not getting reimbursed by Medicare or Medicaid. You put that funding across the hospital in jeopardy by noncompliance. So it's serious.
But in the heat of the moment, you know, when a loved one is impaired or a loved one is dying, I mean, you don't have your paperwork and maybe the hospital is not going to comply with these new rules. I mean, it's very difficult still to make those changes, no?
It's going to take a cultural change. Just issuing a directive from Washington doesn't mean that every hospital will know about it, understand how to implement it. This should be something that, as part of admission, you ask, who's your decision maker? I wouldn't look for a change tomorrow morning. I think it's going to take at least many months, if not a year or two, to really see this sweep through the system.
There are critics of this, as you well know. The Family Research Council, very concerned, says this is another decision by the Obama administration government overreach. Are we hearing a lot of that today?
We're hearing some of that today, but I have to say this. At the end of the day, this is consistent, in fact, not with big government meddling, but with big government opening the door to let families, individuals who care for one another, to work out their decisions in private.
Art Kaplan is professor of bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Microcredit pioneer Grameen Bank of Bangladesh is now expanding to the United States. The bank was founded in 1976 by economist Mohammed Yunus to give small loans to poor people to help them start businesses. It's now a worldwide movement with hundreds of banks and 150 million borrowers. Our guest, bank founder and economist Mohammed Yunus, won a Nobel Peace Prize for putting the idea into practice. He's now expanding the model to issues like health care. Dr. Yunus, when I first interviewed you nearly 10 years ago, you were working hard to expand microlending around the world. Now you have three branches of Grameen Bank in the United States. Why here?
Well, there's millions of people in this country who are not eligible to have received service from the conventional banks. So as a result, you have flourishing payday loans with interest rate as high as 1,000%, 1,500%. And you have check cashing companies, you have pawn shops. So we see a need for a different kind of banking. And we started in Jackson Heights in New York, in Queens. Next branch was in Brooklyn. Now we are invited to do it in Omaha, Nebraska. Last 7 months we are doing it in Omaha, Nebraska. Beautiful. The women taking loans, average loans about $1,500. Repayment is 99.3%. And it helps people.
How are these loans used typically?
To start an income-generating activity like hairdressing salon, pet care, daycare center for children, home cleaning services, bakeries, making embroideries, making custom jewelries, lots of different things. People have a lot of capabilities. Simply, they don't have the opportunity to unleash their creativity because they don't have the money in their hand.
Do you see micro-lending expanding in the United States?
It is. It is expanding. We are invited to start in San Francisco and Salt Lake City, and many others probably will come forward to do the same thing.
Your original idea, Professor, of the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh had a very unique method of lending, basically forming small groups of borrowers. Would you describe it for us, for those of us who may not be familiar?
Basic principle that we adopted right from the beginning. People should not come to the bank. Banks should go to the people. We have over 8 million borrowers everywhere in Bangladesh. So our staff will go and meet them at their doorstep every week to do the banking at their doorstep. And in order to join Grameen Bank, you have to form a group of 5 women, and you pay back in weekly installment. All loans are given for income-generating activity. And as you take the loan, you also have to open a savings account. Every week you put a tiny little money into your savings account. That money grows. The whole loan is paid back over a year or 6 months. Then you are ready to take another loan. And no collateral is needed, no guarantee, no reference of any kind. A branch mobilizes the money from the neighborhood. Each branch has to be self-sufficient in terms of money.
So just so I'm clear, is this exactly what you're doing in the United States or what you plan to be doing?
We do exactly what we do in Bangladesh, and we want to expand it. We would like to create it as a bank. At the moment, it's not a bank. It's organized as an NGO. And as an NGO, we cannot take deposits. So we have to find money to lend money. We're hoping that we can get a license as a credit union or as a bank so that we can start taking deposits. If you can take deposit, then sky's the limit. You can expand it as much as you want.
So, Professor Yunus, this basic model that you started so many years ago of loaning money to women, why has it been so effective, even here in the United States?
The same reason, because women are very cautious with their money, and they bring a lot more benefit to the family than men does. They take good care of the children, they have a longer vision, and they are very committed to their activities. You don't see that as clearly in the case of men. They want to enjoy right away rather than wait for tomorrow and build up for tomorrow. This is a common feature in women everywhere in the world.
Professor Yunus, you founded Grameen Health to bring low-cost health care to the poor. How are you doing it, and how many people are you reaching?
Yeah, we are doing in Bangladesh. It's moving very well. What we talk about is that we can create healthcare as a social business, a business to solve problems rather than make money. We create hospital like Eye Care Hospital. We charge the regular fee to the people who can afford and make money and then pass on this profit to the poor people who don't have to pay as much. So that way it's a self-sustainable. It's not something that you depend on charity. So this is one attempt that we are trying to introduce a social business concept in healthcare.
Transfer the lessons to here in the United States. What are the lessons for us here as we struggle with healthcare reform in this country?
The same thing. This is what you face here in healthcare. It's the same thing in Bangladesh. Healthcare is becoming expensive every day. It doesn't have to be. Once we get out of making money out of the healthcare, a lot of possibilities. Technology is available. Committed people are available. Diagnostic services could be made much, much cheaper. So all these things possible once you remove that profit-making idea.
At a meeting in Mumbai last month, you proposed setting up a stock exchange exclusively for these social enterprises.
Yeah.
So what would a social enterprise stock exchange accomplish?
Today, there's only one type of stock exchange where you go there to make money. All about making money. I'm saying that human beings are not just money-making machines. We are not only selfish people as individuals, we are also selfless people. That selflessness was not introduced into the economic world. And social business is a selfless business where you do it to change the world, change the people's lives. So you have to create a separate stock market where all the social businesses will be listed. And the individual who want to help the poor people, you'll try to select all those companies who are working towards it as a social business. And you want to put your $1,000 into that company and buy shares of that company. And if I needed that money back, I would sell the share and get the money back. So my money is still my money. Unlike charity in a stock exchange, when you're putting this money in a social business, you can sell it back and get your money back.
One microcredit institution called SKS Microfinance in India is holding an initial public offering of stock to shareholders, making it fully for profit. What do you think of that, of microlending completely for profit?
I always had a very clear position on that. We should not encourage people to see poor people as a kind of an opportunity to make money for themselves. Microcredit should be ideally a social business.
Final note, Professor Yunus. Cameras are expected to start rolling this fall in a new movie about you and Grameen Bank. Peter Fonda is part of the cast. Are you working on the film, sir?
Oh, I'm not directly associated with it. This is an Italian producer who wanted to do that. They sent me the script to look at it, but I didn't find it still good enough to do that. So I'll see how it works out.
We'll look for your remarkable story on the big screen, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Economist Mohamed Yunus. He won the Nobel Prize in 2006 for his pioneering work to end poverty in his native Bangladesh by offering microloans to the poor, mostly to poor women. Coming up, spring cleaning tips. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. The days are getting longer, and among other things, all that extra sunshine is illuminating layers of dust and all those unfinished projects that sat around all winter. Whatever your mess, now's the time to take it on. Julie Morgenstern is the author of Shed Your Stuff, Change Your Life. She recently challenged readers of her blog to do more than clean this spring, to think beyond closets and tackle three types of clutter: time, space, and habit. Julie Morgenstern, welcome to Here and Now. Nice to have you.
It's great to be here, Jane.
What's the importance of spring cleaning?
Spring cleaning is this great time of renewal. It gives everybody a chance to clear out anything that accumulated, so that they can get a fresh start and be light on their feet and kind of open for the new things that are going to come into your life.
So from your professional point of view, what's the first step in spring cleaning?
Well, I think you kind of do a little bit of an inventory and identify what I call everything that's stagnant. And those are all of the candidates for your spring cleaning.
How do you decide what's important and what's not?
Well, before you dive in, you really want to ask yourself, if all of this were gone tomorrow, what would I miss? And you'll evaluate things according to those guidelines.
You also recommend, Julie, that we get rid of things that clutter our time. What do you mean by that?
Well, time clutter are all kinds of things that end up on our schedule that at one point made sense, but they're no longer relevant. And we never actually stop to realize, like, well, whoa, what am I still doing on that committee? That really made sense 6 years ago. It doesn't make sense now.
Well, that's one example of time clutter. The last type of clutter you address originates from our habits, checking email, watching TV, even chronic lateness. Talk about some of those habits and how we overcome them.
Yeah, well, mindless escapes is a big one. You know, people spend hours and hours on the internet watching television, and that is clutter that weighs us down. We beat ourselves up over those habits. And all of the time you spend on the habit and the time you spend beating yourself up over it is total clutter. So you want to ask yourself, what is the value of this activity to me? If you can identify the value of the habit before releasing it, it's easier to replace it with something healthy.
What do people learn about themselves when they spring clean?
All these pockets of clutter in your life are opportunities to learn about attachments that you have to people, to belief systems, or even sometimes a part of yourself that you've put on hold. I've had clients kind of discover, wow, that's the creative part of me. That's what all those colorful clothes are that haven't been worn in 12 years, and I need to reactivate that part.
Well, Julie Morgenstern, thank you very much for your time and expertise.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Jane.
Julie Morgenstern is an organizing expert and the author of Shed Your Stuff, Change Your Life. To get to Julie's blog, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Well, beyond all that cleaning, another sure sign of spring, at least here in Boston, is the Boston Marathon. On Monday, more than 25,000 runners representing 71 countries will test themselves over the 26.2-mile course that starts in rural Hopkinton, Massachusetts, and ends in downtown Boston. Runner's World Editor-at-Large Ambie Burfoot is steeped in the history of the Boston Marathon. He won the race in 1968, and he returns just about every year for the race. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock caught up with Burfoot near the finish line yesterday.
Remind me, what was your time in 1968 when you won the race?
In 1968, I ran 2:22, which is horribly pedestrian now. It was a warm day that day.
I'm just wondering where you think we are today in marathoning. I know the world record in the men's race is just under 2 hours and 4 minutes. Where do you think we are in terms of marathon running right now? There seem to be a lot of really top-flight runners who can run 2:05 or 2:06. How do you see this era of marathoning historically?
Yeah, let me say first that 30, 40 years ago, nobody could imagine 2:04. It was just over the moon. We were talking 2:08 then. Now, I don't know how low it can go. I do know that for anyone to break that record here or elsewhere takes a perfect race under perfect conditions on the perfect course. And those things don't often come together, so you have to be very lucky.
Especially in Boston, it's such a difficult course, and it's really unlike the other courses that are used for the World Marathon Majors, Berlin, Chicago, London, those are pretty flat courses for the main.
Those are the flat, fast courses where all the records are held. What's interesting about Boston is that it's a downhill course. So at first blush, you would think that it should be faster than a flat course. That turns out not to be the case for a lot of complicated muscular reasons, but also makes this race more of a strategic and mental race than any other, which makes it very interesting to watch.
Now, I mentioned the world record, 2 hours, 3 minutes, and 59 seconds. I know you spoke to the man who holds that record recently, Haile Gebrselassie, and he told you, I believe, that he thinks someday someone will go under 2 hours.
Yes, he did, and then when I asked for when, he hedged that just a little bit, and I think he said 50 years or something. literally every second or every 5 seconds under the record now is a momentous breakthrough. So I think he said he won't see it in this generation, maybe in his lifetime. I think sub 2 hours for a man is a long, long way off. But people keep getting faster, and I think the Boston course record is ready to be taken down. And I think this is the best field I've ever seen at Boston, so it could be a very exciting race Monday.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about the men's field. How do you see the men's race on Monday? Who will you be watching for?
Well, as a somewhat parochial American, I will be hoping that Ryan Hall and Meb Keflezighi have great races. And, of course, Meb won at New York last fall to break the streak of Americans not winning there. It stretches back to 1983 here. Honestly, they only have a 1 in 10 chance each, 10%, because the Ethiopian and Kenyan runners are so fast and there are so many of them. But they are on the same level as those runners, so I hope they're going to mix it up and make it a real fight to the finish.
Do you think it's just a matter of one of those runners or another American runner just breaking through in one of these big races to open up, I don't want to say a floodgate of American distance runners, but it's clearly in the last few years there's been a sort of resurgence of American distance runners.
There's a definite resurgence going on, and more Americans are beginning to run really fast now in the track and in the marathon. That is also true of the Ethiopians and Kenyans. They're not standing in place. They're getting faster and faster. So Americans are getting much better and moving up onto the podium. Breaking through and winning, though, is very, very tough because the rest of the world doesn't stand still and wait for us.
What can you say about the women's race on Monday? We know the defending women's champion, Selina Kosgei of Kenya, is back to defend her title.
Yeah, I think she's going to be in the running. I think she's got several tough Ethiopian runners, including Dire Tune to compete with. I believe she was second last year. We don't have the Kara Goucher or Dina Castor here this year, so we're not expecting an American in the top three. We hope for some good races. But I think the women's race will be very close up front as it was last year. The women's races are getting more and more competitive every year.
Again, we referenced the fact that you won the race here in 1968. The last American woman to win the race was 1985, Lisa Larson-Weidenbach. Do you remember anything about that race?
I remember it very, very well. Those were the couple of years, the amateur years at Boston, when the field wasn't very strong and the weather was very warm a couple of those years. I talked with Lisa recently. She's coming back and running with her husband and her daughter and is going to have a real silver anniversary celebration. She was one of the great, strong, early pioneers out there. And if she were young, she'd be mixing it up with the best of them today.
Andy Burfoot is Runner's World Editor-at-Large. He spoke with Here and Now's Alex Eshlock. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Jane Clayson. Robin Young returns on Monday. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.